book of an advanced advertiser. If all goes well, this will end up being the second chapter, the second book down the line. The next one, the one to come out ahead of that, will be Death in Contemporary Christian Thought, and then after that, a book on the concept of death. That's a bit of advertising. In case somebody happens to see it, you can actually buy it then. The problem is when it's legitimate to remove a vital organ, say a liver or a heart, where transplantation has produced a series of attempts to define clinical death. That sentence was written long before I got here. So far, none has been successful. The Beecher Committee at Harvard ducked the question by substituting irreversible coma. New technological capacities to maintain vegetables have forced people to consider the economic and social cost of mere life. These sorts of issues are leading people to qualify what they say. Instead of just talking about death per se, there's clinical death and cellular death. The possibility is being discussed that legal death might be different from clinical death. The term social death is being introduced and differentiated from physical death. The niceties and importance of these differentiations may be illustrated in the following case from forensic medicine. A certain man, upset over the marriage of his daughter to a man that a person that he, the father, considered to be a fortune hunter, disowned it. However, he fancied the possibility of being a grandfather. He rewrote his will to provide a rather large bequest to any child born of his daughter before his death. Some months later, he had a heart attack. He came comatose, was rushed to the hospital. In the emergency room, it was determined that his heart had stopped beating. The physician immediately opened his chest and began heart massage. Under stimulation, his heart began to beat again. It continued to beat without artificial support for half an hour, during which time he did not regain consciousness. Then the heart stopped. Surgery efforts proved futile. The man was declared dead. Meanwhile, in the same hospital, a child was born to his daughter during this half hour. The legal issue which had to be settled in court was, when was the man legally dead? When his heart stopped the first time or the second time? Remember, he did not regain consciousness in between. So far as anyone could tell, he never knew he was a grandfather, which is clearly what he'd looked forward to in inserting the clause in his will. When was he in fact dead? When was he legally dead? Well, to date, most discussions of this kind of thing have turned into quibbles over factual details, pieces of rhetorical moralizing, or cries of existential anguish. Philosophical theories about the phenomena of death have been produced. Death has been treated symbolically, spiritually, and anthropologically. Death has been seen as the last enemy, as it is going to be seen as the last enemy in the moment of truth, the final hope and the ultimate ambiguity. Death has been hidden in immortality and identified with the nothing which marks life's horizon. Some of this work is good, some sudden. Some people break the possibility that death might be a very complex sort of thing. Others want it to be very simple. However, put all the discussions together and it begins to look like there is some sort of conceptual confusion in our concept of death. Do we know what we say when we speak of death? Indeed, the trouble with understanding the concept of death seems to be not unlike St. Augustine's famous trouble with the concept of time. This is the way he put it. In our conversation, no word is more familiarly used or more easily recognized than time. We certainly understand what is meant by the words when we use it ourselves and when we hear it used by others. But then he says, I know well enough what it is, provided that nobody asks me. But if I'm asked what it is and try to explain, I am baffled. So for us, do we know what the term death means? Surely we do. If being able to successfully use terms, we should know what they mean. However, most talk about what death means moves very quickly into discussions of theories about death, emotional reactions to death, and sufferment. I'm going to give you the privilege of reading a footnote or two along the way. It's a footnote to start. For instance, Joseph Cooper, in Death and Immortality, translated by R.C. Winston, came out in Burns Notes, London, 1959, devotes a chapter to the vocabulary of death. He does an excellent job of sorting out certain basic claims that are intrinsic to death talk, but every one of these claims carries a native trait, as can be seen in the summary he provides on pages 30 and 31, that quote. Death and dying mean both end and transition, both terror and liberation, both something violent and something maturing from within, something happening to us but also something we ourselves perform, something masculine and occurring by nature but at the same time something that runs counter to all natural volition. How do you state nothing else? Means all these things. I'd like to suggest that theory and emotion can get in the way of perception and lead to confusion. Perhaps we have to get very simple-minded. Instead of starting with claimed definitions or significant insights, it may be helpful to pay attention to how simple sentences work in ordinary speech. Such an examination may suggest the root to see what it claims. Instead of starting with theory and talking about what are the facts, or what is the ultimate significance of death, let's watch what goes on in and is elicited by effective use of death language. In order to do this, I propose a sustained imaginary experiment. The experiment is intended to get us to notice how we use death talk, and also to elicit a recognition of systematic ambiguities in that usage. Now, imagine a child who's been raised on Latin. You're teaching this child to speak English. Further, imagine that this child is familiar with the way verbs are conjugated that happens to have spent his life in a modern, antiseptic atmosphere, where the term Mary and its cousin does not occur and will have no function if it did. We could say, he comes from a world where everything is immortal, but nobody knows it because there's no contrasting mortality. From his perspective, immortal is a meaningless term simply because mortal has no use in his language and mortality has no place in his world. There being no mortal to negate, immortal has no more function than mortal. Our task is to teach the child to use death talk. Let's start with an old-fashioned exercise in conjugation. I die, he, it dies, we die, you die, they die. Knowing the rules of conjugation, the child picks up the tune and begins to sing standard variations on it. I died, he, it died, we died, you died, they died. I am dead, he is dead, we are dead, you are dead, they are dead. I shall die, he shall die, we shall die, you shall die, they shall die. Now, being very precocious, the child continues to develop grammatical variations with an increasing sense of linguistic power. I was dead, he was dead, we were dead, you were dead, they were dead. I shall be dead, he will be dead, we will be dead, you will be dead, they will be dead. I did die, he did die, we did die, You did that. They did that. Now the child begins to ask, so there's a cognate noun, like them. So the dead can be used as an adjective, and deadly as an adverb. We assure the child that there are such things. But we begin to worry about the grammatical generation of nonsense when a child makes up sentences like these. Death comes and goes and silver wins. The dead man got his own death. And his deadly life is a joy to behold. The child is about to take his newfound linguistic powers on a grammatical holiday. If he is not to enter Lewis Carroll's Wonderland, something more than academic grammar will be needed. We try to explain that saying, the dead man got his own breakfast, makes no sense. And we insist that people just don't go around telling others, I am dead. And you died would be a strange way to greet a friend. However, the child's insistent cry disturbs our ear for the language and challenges our powers of explanation. There is nothing for it but to take his newfound talk out of the classroom. We need to get the child into situations where the use of death talk is normal and where it can be tied to other sentences which the child would recognize as being translatable back into his native tongue, deathless Latin. Here, you folks don't get the joke about that exactly. Here, being teachers, we want to do topics systematically. Instead of regular conjugations, we need consistent articulations and controlled context. With this in mind, we begin a field trip. Talking with the child all the time, but being careful to control both what we say to the child and the aspects of our environment that we wish for him to notice. We decide to begin by restricting ourselves to talking about things rather than two people. Whether this sort of death talk is primary or not, we do not know. But it seems easier to get in on. That's just about the way we started this whole conversation. Besides, much of our own formal education has been concerned with establishing objective reference to our language, and we think this is a natural place to begin. For all these reasons, we agree to restrict our guest talk to sentences where the pronoun it could be used as the subject. You see a dog run across the street. When you hear it, we say, it is alive. We see the dog hit by a car. We say, it died. We walk over to look at the carcass of the dog and say, it is dead. The child begins to crack up. The child says, the dog won. It is alive. The car stops the dog running. It died. The dog is still. It is dead. It's lucky for a word that left. Child is learning that when we talk about this, dead and alive are opposites, and that dead is associated with not moving, irreversible. Permanent meaning what? Flat, E-E-G. Things are not happening. Heart is not beating. No stimuli. Now we come upon a sleeping cat. Child announces. The cat is still. It is dead. No, we say, the cat is not dead. It's asleep. Look carefully, you can see it is breathing. Besides, you can wake it up. Cat, cat. See, it jumped up and ran off. It's not dead, but alive. The child expands on the connection between lack of motion in an object and using the word dead. He asks, if something does not move at all, is it dead? We reply, usually, but it's better to say if something cannot move at all, it is dead. Now we come upon a rock. The child examines it. Sight at it. Touches it. And then announces, the rock is dead except when I move it. We agree that many people would say the rest is good, but add, however, removing it does not change that claim. Unless it can move itself, it's dead. Besides, we observe, it may be better not to say the rock is dead at all. It never was able to move itself. Rocks don't die, they just erode. Things are getting a bit sticky, but the child is beginning to see that dust talk fits in with talk about things which once could move themselves, not being able to do so anymore. Sometimes dust talk about it refers to a lack of process or change. It also refers to a contrast between something having motion of its own and not having motion of its own. It's only that's the classical Aristotelian tradition. It is, and Aristotle is the first regularizer of ordinary usage. It's all right to say the rock is dead. It is odd to say the rock dies. An inflated rubber ball comes bouncing down. It lands on a mirror, protruding from a board left carelessly about. With a hit, it breaks free, bounces twice more, then lies flat. The child kicks the ball. It flops over and lies still again. The child asks, did the ball die? We reply, in a manner of speaking, it did. But though it was a live ball, the ball was never alive. It did not really move itself, though it was easy to get it to move. Now that it is punctured, it's hard to get it to move. It's dead now, but it didn't really die because, you see, it never was able to move itself. Dogs and cats can move themselves. About them, there's no question but that we can say they will die, and they die. Talking about balls as live or dead varies from talking about things like dogs and cats. The certain basic rules for using it dies, it is dead, it will die, are being developed through associating death talk with other talk. Die and words like cease, stop, motionless, still, are forming a family for the child. At the same time, we, who are the teachers, are becoming aware of legitimate, but not completely consistent, gradations in usage. Now a much more serious complication rears its head. Having noticed that we use they as the plural form of it, the child quite naturally shifts to the sex and more personal singular pronoun, he and she. A bird flies by, and the child observes. He is not dead. Child sees his playmate run across the street, as the dog did. The playmate is hit by a car, as the dog was. The playmate lies still, as the dog had. The child asks, is he dead? After a brief consultation with the attending physician, we answer in the affirmative. The child runs over to the body of his playmate and calls out, you guys, what happened? Tell me all about it. But if, today, to he and she we have come by easy stages to you, he and she can become either it or you in our ordinary usage. But does this talk work the same way when speaking to you as when talking about it? We've learned something about how to use to die in impersonal it conditions. Now we have to find out if this talk works the same way when talking to someone instead of about something. We have a new problem on our hands. You may not like this kind of event. It may only confuse our neat pedagogical intentions. But that sort of thing happens when we get ourselves out into the field. Ordinary accidents simply do not pay attention to our civilized attempts to control the variables. However, we can still try to salvage the lesson by bringing some order into the confusion. Otherwise, our lesson will go the way of the child's just dead friend. We say to the child, he cannot talk to you. Talking, you see, requires moving. As she is dead, she cannot move, therefore she cannot answer you. The child considers our reduction of communication to motion rather odd. He says, but she used to talk to me on the telephone. Besides, I could hear her when she called from the other side of the house, and I could not see her move then. Let's go home, and I will telephone her. You don't understand, he says. She cannot answer. Why? Has she gone away? Do you mean she won't ever talk with me again? Her body is here? Where is she? Asked the child. Others, if you die, will you no longer talk with me? Will you leave me? Becoming difficult to keep the language lesson dispassionate, but we try. You might say she has gone away. Some people do. But that is a confusing way to talk because it takes going, which is a way of moving, and uses it as a way to talk about ending. It would be right to say, she won't ever talk with me again. And that encourages us to want to say, she isn't here. And then assume that we can say, she went away. But when we say, she went away, we're apt to think she went someplace. Lots of people would claim that she has gone someplace, which they call heaven. Other people would say that talking about a place to which she has gone is simply a confusion produced by asking where she went. Is there an important thing to note? The question there makes the assumption, and if you answer the question as posed, you're in the trap. You know, where'd you go? These people would insist that not here does not imply gone away. In any event, if she has gone someplace, it's not the sort of place where you would find a bed or rock or ball. Perhaps we had better just leave it at, she is dead, she is no longer with us. She cannot be a you to you any longer. And if we die, then we will no longer talk with you. It would be just as if we had gone away and would never come back. There you're right. Paul tries hard to get this new way of talking straight. When you die, you can't do anything with me. Is that right? You are absent, and I am present. So my playmate cannot do anything with you. She is no longer a you to me. But I still want to be a you to her. So we can keep on being you. I want us to keep on being together. Yes, we do. That's why many of us find death is sad. Because if you die, then we can't be we, even should we want to be. Our relationship is broken. When your playmate was alive, the two of you could be together. Now that she is dead, you cannot be. From now on, she will be with you only in memory. When you think of her as being with you, it will be a memorial to the we which was. You can imagine that you talk with her, but you will also imagine the answer. Footnote. Those spiritualists and others who insist that they can and do talk with the dead, and hence would deny the claims of the teacher in this paragraph, are also insisting that death talk be restricted to the if-die type. Such a claim is intelligible, but it also amounts to denying the legitimacy of using this you-are-dead sort of talk. For them, an if can die, but a you cannot. You die is beginning to show affiliation not so much with the ending of motion as the breaking or termination of a relationship. You die fits into sentences for leave, absence, and away at a proper place. To say you are dead is also to say something a bit odd. We have to be together for me to talk to you. If you are dead, then we're not together. And the assertion, you are dead, is addressed to no one. If I say to you, drop dead, I don't mean stop being able to move. I mean, don't be a you with me. Go away, so that we are no longer weak, or something like that. When I say, you die, I am saying something like, we are being separated. Never again will we be together. You are leaving and I am staying, though it may be a mistake to assume that you are moving somewhere. You are dead becomes a way to reflect on the fact that when I talk of us in the future, I will be keeping alive a memory of when we were together, but I will know that we are not now together. However, the object of talking to you when there is no you to talk to is not the object death talk at all. The lesson is about to take yet another nasty turn. The child has something more to teach us. Having already noticed the potential for asking questions about where you go when you leave, questions which depend on whether it talks to you talk. Now he notices the possibility of taking a further step. As he and she can serve as a bridge between it and you, we can serve as a bridge between you and I. My playmate is dead, he explained. Then if she is dead and will never be with me, no matter how much I try to be a you to her, the we which she and I used to be is dead. She is not here. She and I cannot be you. But what if everyone else died? So that there were no you. Would there be any you at all? And if I didn't have somebody to be me with, would I be I? If there was nobody to be me with, I would not be a you to anybody. If I were you to nobody, would I be an I? If I would not be an I, would I be dead? Someone could be all alone. Would he be dead? The bridge from you to me to I has been set. The child asks, would I die? Yes, he says. Everybody dies, you will die too. But our child won't leave it at that. If I will die, then how would I talk when I'm dead? Will I say to myself, I am absent from everyone, I am dead? But will there be a myself to say it to? You could say about me, he is dead, he is no longer with us. But could I say about me, I am dead, I am no longer with you? And if I am a you to nobody, would I also have to say, I am no longer with me? If I said that, I couldn't even talk to myself. Talking would not make any sense. Yet I can say now, I will die. Surely I will be able to say sometime, I die, just as I can now say, you die and she die. But there's something very odd about saying, I am dead. Yes, it seems like I ought to be able to say it. We may be tempted to acknowledge, don't talk that way. It's nonsense. That's what some of the news analysts have been saying about this kind of thing recently. Or we may be tempted to judge the child as a philosopher. And that's what some of the French existentialists have been saying about us like this recently. But either way, it's time for our imaginary experiment to come to an end. The imaginative child has taught us quite enough for one lesson. I do invite you, on your own, to keep the experiment going if you like. There's been a lot of different variations of it. Reflecting on what has happened suggests that the lesson has come full circle. We went into the field to get away from generating grammatical nonsense. We began, satisfactorily enough, by talking about death in its language. get by to be articulated by reference to things that moved in Sharp Neighbor, but always stayed there in our frame of reference. Then last week shifted our focus to Udai. Udai was more troublesome than Iqbal. Udai did not involve a reference so much as a break in the very relationship in which we communicate. Yet we could talk about that relationship and notice how we could be together or apart. There still was a context within which our coupling would go on, though that context depended on there still being some you with which to be we, allowing the you who is dead to be recalled, faced with the problem of how talk goes on if there is neither a system of reference nor a context of relationship. I will die, I die, I am dead, moves us right out of what seems to be normal usage. Meaning the first two you can say, the last one you say, what does that mean? I am dead. Either language is gone on a forced holiday, or talking has become mere chatter. However, we do not know this. A physician might prescribe a forced holiday for us to find out that. I think this is being described yesterday by a psychiatrist, as a matter of fact. An analyst might call us back to the edge of meaningless noise. I am dead is not a way of talking about something to which I can enter, I can refer in a stable reference frame. For my death indicates the end of the locus, which I provide for the frame itself. The ifs are there somewhere out here. But when I say I am dead, it's not something out there, it's the center of the whole thing. It's just that shot down. I am dead is not a way of talking to someone, even in memory, who is in relationship with me. For my death indicates the termination of my involvement in social relationships. At a speculative level, the philosopher's question about whether or not a private language is possible has been given a particularly striking expression here. Can we talk at all without regular reference frames, established infant systems, and enduring social context? The very least attempts to talk about what it would be like to talk without reference infant of communication sounds paradoxical. Whether impossible in itself or not, paying attention to attempts to talk about one's own death leads to a discovery of the significance of frames and context for our talking. When there is nothing to talk about and no one to talk to, hasn't talk become meaningless now? I am dead seems to be a bit of speech that lacks reference, draws on unusual ways of communicating and violates our normal notions of context. However, this may not finally mean that such talk is meaningless. At this stage, there is just no way to tell. To speak of my own death may be meaningless, but it also may be one of the most profound ways of calling attention to an essential condition of meaningfulness. It forces us to ask whether selves are parasitic on systems, or whether systems are dependent on selves. It also suggests that we could ask whether such a question can be asked. One of the reasons the lesson in death talk became so difficult when the child got to I die is the slippery character of paradox. Saying I am dead sounds like saying I am not I. That would be a technical paradox, self-contradiction. However, it could equally say, I am not an it, nor am I a you. But if to be an I depends on being an it, or a you, or both, then there is no I to not be an it or you. And if talking at all intrinsically depends on it to talk about and you to talk to, then saying I am not I is intrinsically paradoxical. Does the discussion discovery of this paradox legislate against there being any intrinsic significance to talk about my own death. Or may the very paradoxicality of first-person singular death talk point to the roots of the meaning of all ways of speaking of death, whether within or beyond systems of reference and context of relationship. Well, here's all the freedom. Can we legislate against everything such strange sentences as I am dead? Or can we reformulate the possible conjugations of to die so as to remove the oddness of addressing somebody who can only be remembered when we say you are dead? Or is it the case that it is dead would mean nothing more than it can't mean, except that we attribute to every it and I, which is or was, a participant in relationship with you and the locus of the frame of reference? There are people that argue that something in this area is what's important, not clearly. For instance, holds that every person has a primordial death threat, something like saying, I not only shall die, but I am dying and I am dead. Again, could not be that death is first found in the ending of you, when there is nothing left but to say you are dead. Martin Heidegger, for example, seems to maintain that death is the end of concern with a you, without which there is no I and no world, and therefore no I to die and no it to die either. But these questions about what we should do with our language, whether we should legislate and hear it's meaningful or isn't meaningful, don't answer themselves. But I think our imaginary experiment suggests a way of moving toward answering them. Could answering questions like these depend on sorting out the relationship among the ways we use death talk? If I'm right in suspecting that there are three primary sorts of death talk, then each sort of death talk may serve to generate a fundamental model within which theories intended to explicate the concept of death will tend to develop. However, if there are three sorts of death talk and three corresponding models, it raises an initial question: are there three concepts or one? I've got some other text here. Here I'm seeing ourselves applying this to some traditional philosophical problems, and I can also apply it to things that we work with here. Let me sort of skip through some of this, and I'm going to find out what I have to say here. So I'll start my little graduate over here. To moving you in the direction of seeing how this sort of thing may apply to the stuff that we've talked about here. So I'll just turn over these pages and go through another little piece back here. What is happening on Friday night? Clinical death. The child dies. Yes. So what was the doctor concerned about when he worked with the it? Central nervous system. Why the central nervous system? Well, that's the closest tie he could find between an it and you. Isn't it? What he was really bothered about, what the whole business of medical ethics he started about there seems to be that we care for you. That we care for you physically as a body, which is an it. So we're concerned about your body operating. Now, can the central nervous system provide a translation between it and you? Dr. Benson. He was concerned about I die. Death talk, it seems to me. He cast it in process language. There's a process, you grow, there's a chance of getting somewhere. That came through to me as partly it talk, something happening. And partly you talk. You talk is a decision language. You've got to decide. And now, you know that things don't decide. They're not part of a normal way of talking. But people do. Okay? Now, can we do the two of them at the same time? Or do you get a fifth talking that goes on and confuses it? You're talking about one sort of death and another sort of language when you cross our thoughts and generate there. And we are puzzled, at least, if I'm trying to think theoretically, something very close to nonsense. Last night's panic. But we were concerned about. Now we had you die right ahead of us. That was a good deal of the discussion. If, what do we do when this person, he, who is, wants to be a you to me sometimes, or I want to be a you to him or her. That's what's important, isn't it?
Doesn't this a good deal of the focus of the planet?
But how did we talk about it? Well, we talked about it in terms of I, how it bothers me, and how to control it. What am I supposed to do with it? The first question, for instance. Are we getting into some of these same kinds of puzzles? Now, some of you may want to then say, well, perhaps we should just get the whole thing settled down and do. I don't want to let you go that easily when I end with this glass of milk. If language about death and I talk of death seem to be potentially independent, this is the classical way that the mind-body problem got started. The mind is the I, the body is the it. And you can do all of the talking about it without bothering with the I. Tom Cobol has written a book called Skepticism in the First Person, in which he tries to show that all sentences that have I can have the I deleted and not lose any meaning. And it works that way, provided this language is all you're interested in. But you can also use I language without bothering about any it. This way of talking is one of our ways of latching onto the world. And I'm inclined to say that generally it's the mind-body problem. The mind is your I, the body is your it. And never the same needs me. But there's a puzzle, they do seem to, and you try to figure out how. Your you might be a tie between the two of them. It might be the focus of significance of the death question in human medicine is precisely there. That it can become a you to me, and there I've got an I. But unfortunately, you can be treated as if you're independent, at least from it. So I don't have to have an it around. Christians particularly have to be aware of that, of these people who are around Christians. So the Christian claims to say to God, and theologians speak of the death of God, and so far as I know, they haven't found an it. So some of the hang-ups are trying to make God into an it. This is where we have the use of the thou language that leaders like the West German German speak. Now, can you be independent from us? Can we have you language that works completely independently from our language? Yes. Remember, we had a discussion of the rational estate yesterday, in which you would be forced to be free, that kind of thing. It seems to me that's a you without an air. If you're developing a system where there are relationships going on, but there is no acknowledgement of a point of reference in the relationship that is independent from the relationship. Yeah, that all is to suggest that it is indeed possible not to assume that it language, for instance, is dominant. The scientist tends to assume that it is. So what the scientist has to say, I think, is what he does. He deals with it language. There's also U language, and it doesn't mean it's inappropriate. And the U language may be independent. And there's I language, and it may be independent. Now you come around to the other end of it. You also might claim that all three are necessary, and that death can be identified at any one point and involve the other two. As the end of the process, as the break of the relationship, as the denial of a relationship. Without any one of them, the other two collapse, might be a threat. That we haven't explored, but those kinds of things, I think, need to be explored so that we can get clear about what it is that's bothering us when we get bothered. This exercise here is the largely conceptual, but I hope you see its potential for helping us to untangle some of the points at which our emotions get involved and our feelings get hung up. With that, I'd be sure to see if you have any questions. Thank you very much. I'll open the yes, this is Cecilia. Alicia, excuse me. Thank you.
I don't know what I'm going to do.
people are instant power. It seems to be theoretically generative. No, I didn't discuss it. I just tried to show each step down the line. And when I talked this over with the chaplain who discusses the philosophy of psychology, and he's very disturbed by the first potential independence, or I would like to say point of reference. That's the shift from it to you. He is of the he tends to have the bias which is built into a system like Freud, for instance, and I think it's built into much of our scientific language. If you don't have something to talk about, then there's no potential for having a you to talk to. And that was the point at which I said at least Christians have to be able to recognize the possibility that we think that it's meaningful to talk to a you for whom there is no it. Now, the question at the other end, I think it's not too bothered by the I for whom there is no you. You see, there are many analysts who say that's not intelligible. And there would be, excuse me, analysts, that's a philosophical term, I'm not talking about psychoanalysts, these are philosophical analysts. So that would not be intelligible, because you have to have a system. Or else there is no talk going on. There's just this nonsense to talk about an I that's alone. That's the existential time after, and they just generate nonsense. It's just language, the playing games. There are other people that say it's very significant. And there are ways of developing it. And I indicate there is the potential for people saying, I is the whole story. If there is any significance to you die and it dies, it's parasitic. If the I dies, it's the important question. Like the here it dies man may say, if there's any significance to you die and I die, it's parasitic. It dies is really the meaning of death. So I was proposing the possibility that you might operate also independently. I think the reason that there's a puzzle is that you look like it requires a relationship. And I'd like to pose for you something that's being struggled with in contemporary logic, just to note it, possibility. Traditional logic has assumed that there must be two terms, at least, to a logical formulation, for there to be any logical relationship. We can now say the you business is the relationship, the terms, or the I. One of them is an I that makes the other a you. But recently, logicians have been struggling with the question of whether they could have a logical relationship without any terms. Now, if you could, you would have something like the you that makes the we without any I. And I was suggesting that Father Keith's discussion of the utilitarian rational state is a kind of context in which there are yous but no acknowledgement of an I anywhere. And it is that insofar as I die, if I now go back to the die question, that it isn't I die that means anything, or it dies that means anything, it's the you die. Now it may be that on investigation that would turn out to be sort of a we, that either we are we or there is no one. But I want to be very careful that I don't get too close to the I, because I think people who talk this way are really quite serious in saying there is no significance to the independent I. That I die is a meaningless question. But that you die is not meaningless. That's social death. Question of whether somebody could carry off one of these. In this case, we're saying, no, the eyes turned out to be present. I think, in fact, it's quite clear to me that our Western Judeo-Christian tradition says the eye is very important. And that's part of what you were talking about yesterday. I'm not sure that I've have to force myself to be married to it. And one reason I'm not sure is when I first started work on this, it's kind of an avocation of mine. I've been chipping away after several years. I just started with the assumption, of course, biological death is primary. That's what God says. Then I began to work on this you die kind of thing, going through a good deal of biblical and anthropological material. And I slowly began to bend. First, I decided, no, you could start there. And it's intelligible for people to say, as they do in many primitive tribes, the body is dead, but he isn't. We'll have a ritual funeral later. That's when he died. Well, that kind of thing. Then it occurred to me that maybe that's what makes the body run. And you can develop a whole ontology around the notion that it's the interpersonal relationship, not just with me, but this is almost something that seems to be present in Heidegger, I think. All of the it process depends upon there being this interactive relationship. Break the relationship and then the process goes. That led me to the possibility that we actually really shift our whole focus to make the you. And once I had done that, I decided I'd better be jolly careful that my own assumptions didn't control what I allowed as nonsense or not nonsense, and open up some possibilities for a whole series of alternatives, and then wrestle it back down the line. At the moment, my own conviction is that we've got to somehow or other recognize that the three ways of using death are not the same. I think we've got some great confusion in skipping back and forth in our language amongst them. And at the same time recognize that we can't get along without all three. This is what I would call systematic ambiguity. Maybe you can develop a kind of economic synergy of the three. You know, that each of the three is not the other, but they all are, kind of thing. But that's the job that would really blow your mind, if you could follow anything of what I was doing today. I think, don't think it can be done orally. And I'm not sure it can be done. is to say God is both perfect and has a will. He is good, has, right? Perfect, ready. And he decides. And we produce all kinds of theological quibbles over that. How can he be both? Which is it? Is that just God will good? Or does it God will good? Well, God is good, you know. Perfect. God will. Right, now we're back at the death level. When you get Christianity moving along with the death issue, you will be inclined, just in the way we've been educated, the language we've used about God, to shift back and forth. The ultimate system. It is there. It's all over. It will be all right. When you die, you pass over to the other side, where everything is at peace, and everything is in an order, and makes sense. Your soul is a thing which goes over. On the other hand, when you die, you face God. He will be with you. You will be with him. And you just need to get right back and forth between the two of them. That's the way we've been educated. And we're getting this now. I said at the end, my own private condition, right, when I like to work out, is that you do need all three. But the statistics have to be made. And then we need to get our bridges in order. So we know where we're going back and forth. But when we don't, that's when we get into confusion, I think. When we don't notice that we've shifted from one to the other. Myself in the past. And that may help you get a hold of what we're doing with the eye test.